We heard this morning from Ron about the information in biological systems, genomes, protein structure, complexes, cells, organelles, organs, and so on. And so the goal of my presentation is to show you how cryo-EM fills the resolution gap between atomic resolution techniques such as NMR spectroscopy and X-ray crystallography, and cellular imaging techniques such as confocal microscopy. This slide summarizes the concepts I'd like you to take away from the next presentation. This presentation will last about an hour and a half. I'm sure I can go faster. And so what I encourage you to do is close your books. This is in your handout. Sit back and enjoy the show. Of course, the chemistry of life involves interactions between water, amino acids, carbohydrates, and lipids. And these atoms and molecules are organized into higher order secondary structures such as helices and DNA, protein structure, alpha helices, beta sheet. The next level of structural organization is tertiary structure, as you see here in the atomic model of superoxide dismutase. Moving to higher resolution, higher order structures, you can see this antibody structure, which is substantially larger than SOD. And at another level of organization, you can see an enormous quaternary structure, an icosahedral virus, about 600 angstroms in diameter. Moving on, you can see how the virus is dwarfed by a bacterium. And in fact, the bacterium is fairly small compared to the comparable sizes for red blood cells and white blood cells. So how do we span the information gap? Well, let's keep going and think about the maximum dimension of the universe, about 10 billion light years, and the minimum dimension. This is a paper published in Nature where they used electron diffraction to look and visualize orbitals in a copper oxide alloy. And it highlights the point that the microscopes we use can achieve atomic resolution for near-perfect crystals. If we look at lengths and dimensions in biology, here's a peptide bond of about an angstrom. But if you continue on the edge of the universe, we're spanning about, I think, 37 orders of magnitude. There are about six orders of magnitude that we're interested in. Of course, the graduate students are usually interested in the distance between the molecular biology building and the cafeteria. Let's also think about velocities, turnover, and events, because we're interested in dynamics of living systems. And here you can see that in von catalysis, you can have turnover rates of 1,000 or several thousand molecules a second, exceedingly rapid processes that we're studying. I also thought it would be worthwhile to display one image showing that dynamics is also applied in medicine. This is an ultrasound image of a patient's heart that had an exercise test, and that's at rest, higher level of exercise, and at peak, and subsequently at rest. At first glance, having not seen such images before, it'll be difficult for you to appreciate that, in fact, the motion of the heart here is distinctly abnormal, and this is a tip-off that this patient had a blockage in a coronary artery and ended up requiring angioplasty. MRI techniques are now achieving resolutions on the order of about a millimeter, and with higher field strength magnets, there's the possibility of even higher resolution on the order of fractions of a millimeter. This is an example of a patient that had a leaky valve. And in addition to looking at the reflectivity from tissue, we can also look at blood flow. And we colorize the blood according to whether it's flowing towards us or away from us. And if you see, there's a tremendous blue streak here as a consequence of leakiness in this valve, mitral valve. And after surgery, there's improved structure in the valve. And there's just a little bit of leak that is located about right here. So this highlights that even at the level of organs, we can obtain information about structure, function, and dynamics. So in exploring the dynamics of cells and macromolecules, I've listed here a variety of techniques that are used. HD exchange, antibody labeling, very commonly used now to combine protease sensitivity with mass spectrometry. Of course, you're familiar with spectroscopic methods. Single molecule analysis by fluorescence spectroscopy. Dynamics can also be examined by NMR spectroscopy. And imaging techniques with confocal microscopy and GFP labeling, there's a possibility of examining cellular processes almost at the single molecule level. And in fact, using live cell fluorescence energy transfer, it is possible to look at interacting partners. Keep in mind that in biology, so many of the interactions are weak, such as phosphorylation. A kinase touches a protein, phosphorylates a serine, and then leaves. So we seek to examine complexes. On the other hand, there are interacting partners that are quite dynamic, and live cell PRET allows you to look at those. You'll be hearing about cryo-EM throughout the course, and I'll mention atomic force microscopy briefly, and time-resolved X-ray crystallography can be used to look at atomic events within proteins. So in the resolution range between molecules and cells, there's this gap, and cryo-EM fills that gap between high-resolution techniques and cellular imaging techniques. Atomic force microscopy can be used to image the topography of cell surfaces and can reach near atomic resolution in the best circumstances. And as you'll hear throughout the meeting, cryo-EM and image analysis can routinely derive three-dimensional mass at about 25 angstroms resolution. And for specimens with inherent symmetry, there's the possibility of achieving resolutions better than 10 angstroms. Shown here is the tip that's used for imaging in atomic force microscopy. This is provided by Andreas Engel, and he uses the analogy that the tip is sort of like the blind man tapping his stick so that he can discern his path. And the Z resolution in atomic force microscopy is exceedingly good. The piezo allows resolutions on the order of an angstrom. As a consequence of the large size of the tip compared to biological surfaces, the XY resolution is decreased, and biological specimens are also deformable. That limits the XY resolution, and there are these interactions between the tip and the surface. Nevertheless, you can obtain quite valuable information about the force of interactions, and Andreas provided some of his best images here of the aquaporin called MIP and lens, and comparing that to a projection density map of two-dimensional crystals that you'll be hearing more about. And you can see the individual tetramers in their specimens. Richard Henderson, as you know, solved the first structure to atomic resolution using electron crystallography. This is a key paper in the field. And Andreas Engel has used bacteriorhodopsin as a model system to study the limits of atomic force microscopy. And I point out the extracellular surface here. And in looking at bacteriorhodopsin crystals, he's able to image the individual trimers. And what impressed me is that if you compute the diffraction pattern, the information extends to almost 5 angstroms resolution. So in the optimal cases, you can achieve near atomic resolution, even with AFM. Again, that's just surface topography. Shown here is a gallery of structures derived by cryo-EM and image analysis. And we heard from Bob Glazer there's a limit on the thickness of specimens. And in the upper left, rotavirus is about 1,000 angstroms in diameter. So that's reaching about the upper limit. And if you look here, at the same scale are cellular proteins. In most instances, these molecules are examined by two-dimensional crystallography. In some instances, as I'll be describing, it's possible to use single particle analysis to start to derive a maps of molecules even this small. Well, in conventional electron microscopy, I'm sure you're all familiar with negative staining, in which the biological sample is embedded in a heavy metal, as you see here. This is a schematic of a virus particle, for instance. And the problem is that when you dry the specimen, there's substantial deformation. And this, of course, limits the resolution and is prone to artifact. You've all seen the cryo plungers now. Say 4 to 5 microliters of sample is applied to the grid, blotted to near dryness, and then plunged within milliseconds into ethane, so that the specimen freezes at about a million degrees per second, and the water, therefore, is not converted to crystalline ice as in snowflakes, but to vitrified ice, and in that condition, it's an exquisite way to preserve biological structure. I think some of you have seen the cryo stage, the Gatan 66 stage, and the cryo microscope. And of course, part of the art of microscopy is to transfer the specimen quickly so that there isn't contamination as a consequence of condensation on your grid. Well, we heard from Bob Glaser this morning about his pioneering contributions in cryo microscopy. We'll hear from Nigel later in the meeting about his work on the acetylcholine receptor, and you can see he has an affinity for the cold and is probably contemplating the design of a new cryo stage. I'd like to highlight now a variety of experiments by scientists here at Scripps and participants in the meeting that exemplifies this concept of atoms to cells. And I'll start by describing some experiments in Delia Fowler's lab, where she's using live cell imaging to look at the assembly of muscle filaments. And in this experiment, they were able to add CAPZ to actin and look at the dynamics and determine rates of extension and polymerization and depolymerization. And derive kinetics such that the subunit exchange is on the order of 10 to 15 minutes. So it's possible to obtain kinetic information on live cells. And as you know, Ron has pioneered the application of cryo-EM in muscle filaments and microtubules. Shown here is an image of actin filaments decorated with myosin heads. And they have the characteristic barbed appearance. This was the first paper that I'm aware of where a variety of maps were combined using difference imaging so that you could delineate the molecular components in a complex such as actomyosin. See the tropomyosin here. And Ron alluded to his collaboration with Dan Safer, where they were first used UNDECA gold to identify a particular cysteine in actin subunits. In addition, another aspect of this work that impressed me was the use of difference map analysis to look at the amino terminus of the myosin light chain, which was on the order of 4.2 kilodaltons. It's quite small. And the maps are at about 25 angstroms resolution. And this highlights the idea that even at low resolution, you can determine the centroid position of a mass. The boundary may not be well defined because the resolution is low, but in terms of locating its position, even at low resolution, it's possible. And then Ivan Raymond solved the crystal structure of the S1 fragment of myosin, and this docked beautifully into the cryo-EM molecular envelope. Turning to chromosome dynamics, I highlight here the work of Kevin Sullivan, whose lab is here at Symbio. Now, this is a static image of a confocal stack. It's not a live cell experiment. But using GFP labeling, it's possible to locate kinetic cores and then a separate label for microtubules and the chromosomes. Here we're looking at microtubule dynamics in live cells, the work of Claire Waterman Storer, whose laboratory is also here at SynBio. Here she was using GFP tags to look at the assembly and disassembly of microtubules with a MAP, a microtubule-associated protein. What impresses me is the incredible speed with which the filaments assemble and disassemble. And then Ron, as you know, has also used cryo-EM to examine the structure of microtubules. And again, using selective labeling, you can look at the structure of the microtubule filament, a monomer of a motor protein, a kinesin NCD, and the dimer form. And from the relationships between the binding of monomer and dimer, you can infer possible mechanisms how the motors move on the tubule. I think you've probably seen the animation in the control room that summarizes the possible way that myosin heads move on actin and kinesin heads move on microtubules. And you can talk to Ron about the details of ATP hydrolysis and the molecular gymnastics of these systems. I'd now like to highlight some work from Dick McIntosh's lab in Colorado. And now, trying to understand the complexity of cellular architecture, Dick is using a free substitution technique where cells are frozen within milliseconds, and then over a period of days, the water is exchanged for acetone, and then the specimens can be stained with osmium and then embedded in plastic in section. And this is a tomographic series, and it's a double tilt stage to complete the 3D analysis. It's exquisite detail. Now, having derived the two tilt series, you can then computationally examine the volume. This is slicing through. And in the McIntosh lab, they've developed software to start to identify vesicles, so bounded structures, as well as filaments and small particles. It's a way of starting to tease apart the different structures and organelles in the cell. This is a result of that kind of approach where you can delineate the Golgi stack adjacent to the nucleus, and even more detail, you can delineate ER, mitochondria, ribosomes, microtubules, and vesicles. They're examining beta cells from the pancreas, so these are insulin-secreting cells, and you can imagine that these sorts of experiments will be critical for understanding what happens in cells that are unable to produce insulin, or they're also patients that are unable to have vesicle fusion with the membrane to secrete insulin. It will be quite fascinating to see a comparison between the cellular architecture in those two conditions. There are also medications that are used that facilitate a secretion of vesicles and release of insulin. So from this kind of analysis, Golgi stack, the cisternae are closely opposed to each other. The endoplasmic reticulum is a continuous membrane network in close proximity to the Golgi cisternae and also the mitochondria. I'd now like to give some examples of virus structure analysis. And in this particular instance, real virus, it exists in three particle forms, an intact virion, a form that can bind to cell surface receptors and is taken into endosomes, and a third particle form. And this, again, highlights the advantages and disadvantages of cryo-EM. On the left, you can see negatively stained particles. The surface features are clearly evident. And because they're is no negative stain in the frozen hydrated specimen, the contrast is very low. And as we heard from Bob, we take advantage of judicious defocusing to have contrast in our images. Well, for the image processing techniques, it takes advantage of the projection theorem. And for a field of particles, as I showed you, for identical particles, the 2D images represent projections of the three-dimensional structure. And if you compute the Fourier transform, that represents a central slice through the origin in reciprocal space. And if you can sort out the angular relationships between the two-dimensional Fourier transforms, then you can recombine the data, compute an inverse transform, and derive a three-dimensional structure. Now, in icosahedral viruses, there are Euler angles theta and phi, as in any single particle. We take advantage of the 60-fold symmetry, so it's possible to derive a three-dimensional structure from one particle as a consequence of the symmetry. And if you have 10 particles and 60-fold symmetry, it would be equivalent to having 600 particles of a particle with no symmetry. So the computational challenge then is to sort out the theta and phi orientation angles. And in the plane, the rotation angle is omega in the plane of the micrograph. Now it turns out that for icosahedra, as a consequence of the icosahedral symmetry, the Fourier transform contains pairs of lines along which the Fourier transform values are the same, so-called common lines. And so we can take advantage of this to determine the angular relationships between different particle views. We search for the common lines. This is a brute force method to derive a three-dimensional structure. If you have a model, you can also derive a 3D structure by back projections, as I'll describe. Well, having sorted out the orientation angles, you can plot those. And in icosahedra, you have threefold symmetry axes, fivefold vertices, and twofold symmetry axes, as you see here. And each point corresponds to a single particle with its particular orientation angles. And you can combine that data to derive a three-dimensional map. I described reovirus as having three particle forms, and Kelly Dryden, who's one of the tutors in the course, saw these three structures. And then by comparison, you can look at how in moving from the blue particle to the red particle, you release that outer layer. And then at the fivefold vertex position, there's a conformational change in the spike protein, the hemagglutinin. And in conversion from the red to the yellow particle, there's release of these red trimers and a dramatic conformational change at the fivefold vertex with these subunits swinging up and out to form that crown-like structure. Well, it turns out that the gold particle I showed has a transcriptase, which is located at the fivefold vertex positions, and the crown-like structures are a capping enzyme. And one experiment to exemplify the dynamics and the ways that we can trap metastable particles is to activate transcription and then freeze the specimen. And that's what was performed in this experiment, where the four bases in ATP were added to the sample and then incubated at 37 degrees and then rapidly frozen. And you can appreciate these fiber-like extensions on the surface of the particles. So this clearly shows that when transcription is activated, you don't lose the symmetry. And we interpret these fibers as newly synthesized RNA exiting the particles. So with a three-dimensional reconstruction, you can start to compare the inactive and active particles, inactive and active, and keep in mind that with cryo-EM, we don't see just surface topography as in negative staining, but we have the entire three-dimensional volume, as shown here, our central slices. And at the center of these crown-like structures, you can see additional density that we interpret as RNA exiting the particle that's constrained to the icosahedral symmetry as it moves out of the particle. And this is a surface view where in the inactive particle, these crown-like pentamers have a central channel, and then there's this addition of density. So in the active state. This shows a comparison of the two structures, and there's some breathing that takes place in the surface and some movement of the subunits in the capping enzyme and the exit of the RNA strands. I'd also like to point out some experiments on rotavirus. And in this difference map analysis, we compared particles with the surface hemagglutinin and particles that were spikeless, and you can see how clean the difference maps are. And for this experiment, we actually mixed the two particle forms because we're looking at a very small molecular weight compared to the entire particle. So in this sort of approach, it's like determining the weight of the ship's captain by subtracting the weight of the ship from that of the ship plus the ship's captain. And again, with cryo-EM, we determine the entire three-dimensional structure so that you can computationally examine the interior, and the particle has been colorized to show the three layers of protein and the surface spikes determined in the difference map analysis. Now, antibody labeling is a very powerful way to identify specific sites in macromolecular complexes. And in this experiment, Kelly Dryden and Mariana Tahova found monoclonal antibodies to sites that are known to react with cell surface receptors. The red antibody binds sialic acid, and the green binds a membrane permeabilization site. And there's sufficient definition in the maps that we can dock canonical FAB structures and begin to delineate the interactions of the hypervariable loops with the surface of the hemagglutinin. Well, another example of using cryo-EM combined with X-ray crystallography to look at metastable particles is shown here, in collaboration with Jack Johnson. Jack's group was able to solve the crystal structure of this particular virus. And when the individual polypeptide subunit was expressed in insect cells, these particles assembled. And we could derive the MAT by cryo-EM and image analysis. You see the molecular envelope. And with the subunit crystal structures, we could refine those into this density envelope to determine what is called a pseudoatomic model and start to look at the molecular transitions and when the pH is lowered, moving from this expanded, rounded spherical structure to this more angular closed structure. I should add that this kind of analysis kind of highlights the next level of polypeptide folding. As you know, Christian Anfinsen received the Nobel Prize for the concept that a single polypeptide chain contains, that linear information contains the rules that guide formation of secondary and tertiary structure. Of course, it's more complicated when chaperones are required. And what I find fascinating is that in viruses, you still have a single polypeptide chain. It not only folds the individual subunit, but it also dictates the formation of these huge megadalton structures. And these kinds of intermediates that we detect are like folding intermediates for individual polypeptides. Well, this particle is really metastable, cannot be obtained in large quantities, so it's not accessible for three-dimensional crystallization. So this is the sort of approach that can be used to derive a pseudoatomic model. I'd now like to highlight a single particle analysis of integrins, and I wanted to show you what happens when integrins are activated. So on the left is some beautiful imaging from Klaus Lay's lab at the University of Virginia. And on the right, when a particular white cell integrin is activated, you can see how they clump at the site where the endothelium has been disrupted. Now, the same thing happens when platelets are activated. And in that case, a clot forms, and patients can either sustain a stroke or a heart attack. There's a great deal of interest in integrins and how they signal. The biology is fascinating. So you have this large extracellular domain and a small cytoplasmic domain. It's a heterodimer, so it does not have inherent symmetry. And each subunit has a single transmembrane span, and a variety of simple mechanical models have been proposed for what happens when ligand binds to the extracellular domain, and a conformational change is propagated through the structure, culminating in a change in conformation on the cytoplasmic domain that activates cell signaling cascades, ultimately leading to changes in transcription. Well, there are a variety of integrins involved in heart disease, and Brian Adair in my group has been examining alpha-2b beta-3, the platelet, primary platelet integrin. And drug companies are quite interested in alpha-2b beta-3 as a drug target. In fact, some of the drugs that you see listed here, Tegrelin, Eggerstat, are used to dissolve clots in patients with heart attacks. So Brian tried to grow two-dimensional crystals, but was not successful. And he decided to take the approach of imaging integrins as single molecules, as I've described for these large structures like viruses that are 1,000 angstroms. The integrin is about 150 angstroms. And this slide summarizes a schematic of the approach. And, of course, you'll be hearing all the details from Joachim Frank for the SPIDER package and from Steve Lukey for EMAN. Imagine that you have a starting model. You can take you can compute projections from that three-dimensional model, and then you compare those projections with your images to identify those images that are closest to the projection that you've computed. Then you can average all those images, so-called class averages, and start building up averages of particles with the same view. And from that, you can compute a three-dimensional map, and it should have higher clarity because you've included many more particles, and then you may discern additional features in the structure that you can then will be incorporated into the next round of back projections. Shown here are representative particle images, class averages, and back projections of three-dimensional map. And you can barely make out the particles in the raw images. There's higher clarity when, say, 100 to 200 particles are averaged, and higher clarity still in the back projection from the three-dimensional map. Now, how is resolution calculated? Well, you'll be hearing a great deal about that. And one approach is to divide your data set in half and then compute two independent maps and then compare them versus resolution. And so it's 50, 40, 30, 20, 10 angstroms resolution. And of course, at high resolution, there's no correlation at all. And a cutoff value of about 0.5 is arbitrarily selected as a conservative way to estimate resolution. Richard Henderson has a paper in press where he feels that 0.2 perhaps is a better criterion, that we're being too strict. But this is one way to assess resolution of the maps. Shown here are different views, and I have to say that when Brian first displayed this on the computer screen, it generated a few laughs because of the similarity to some new alien life form or a chicken leg. Nevertheless, he soldiered on and interpreted the structure as you see here, where the large domain is about the right size for the ectodomain of the integrin, and the small cytoplasmic domains are shown here. We were surprised to see this connecting rod of density. Remember, I said that there are two transmembrane domains in each subunit, and at low resolution, about 20 angstroms resolution, the rod is about the right size for a coil-coil, alpha helical coil-coil. Consequently, Brian examined the sequences of a variety of isoforms of the alpha chain and the beta chain, and there are conserved arginine and aspartic acid residues. It's been shown that if you swap these two residues, you maintain signaling, but if you remove any one of them, then signaling is eliminated. So we could use that as a way to orient the vertical register of the helices. Now, alpha helices can associate either in a left or right-handed fashion, as you see here. And in reference to the amino acid sequences, we can use the aspartic acid and the arginine to orient helical wheel plots, and this is the left-handed case. The conserved residues are shown in yellow, and you can see that in the left-handed case, they're sort of sprinkled all the way around the helical wheel. But in the right-handed case, they're really concentrated at the interface. And so the idea is that the transmembrane domains associate as a right-handed alpha helical coil as in glycophorin. So this is one way to sort of bootstrap information from a low-resolution map from sequence analysis to simple chemical rules. And in fact, a recent theoretical study concluded that the transmembrane domains of integrins associate in glycophorin A, which would be right-handed. Well, what else can we determine about the low-resolution structure? About the same time Brian was completed his map, Amin Arnaud's group at Harvard published a crystal structure of an integrin ectodomain, and there are 12 individual folding domains in the two alpha, in the alpha and beta chain. The surprise was that the membrane proximal ends were folded back against the ligand binding site. So this was the crystal structure. And it was clear that this kind of bending back and jackknife conformation was a result of crystal packing forces. Nevertheless, it provided individual folding domains that we could use to dock that into the low-resolution map. And this is just one possible way to dock the ectodomain of alpha V beta 3 into the integrin alpha 2B beta 3. You can see that for the head domain, there's a surprisingly good fit. In this body and tail region, there's less certainty about the packing of the individual domains. Nevertheless, it's possible to propose a model for how signaling may take place. For instance, if you look at the alpha chain, we have IG-like domains that are connected in tandem. And by analogy to Fab molecules, these would be the joints would be similar to elbow angles. It may be the case that when ligand binds, there's a conformational change in the head that's transmitted to the alpha chain, leading to bending at these joints and collapse of the structure. I've also known that in the beta chain, there are disulfide bonds in these EGF motifs, and disulfide shuffling could also play an important role. Interestingly, in the crystal structure, a lot of the map was invisible due to disorders, say, in the EGF1 and EGF2 domains. We sort of think of the alpha chain as sort of the spine of the molecule, so signaling may be triggered here, and then you have this ordered collapse in the structure. It's just a model, but a number of antibodies have been purified to different subunits, and you can imagine doing some labeling experiments to localize where the different subunits are in the structure. Well, now I'd like to shift to a description of 2D crystal analysis, and I'll present three experiments that highlight three ways to grow two-dimensional crystals, so-called in situ crystallization, in vitro, and lipid monolayer crystallization. In in situ crystallization, the membrane protein is already concentrated in the plane of the bilayer, and you can extract lipids with detergents, thereby concentrating the protein in optimal circumstances grow two-dimensional crystals. In this condition, you purify protein detergent micelles and you add lipids to that, detergent solubilized lipids, remove the detergent by dialysis, and at a high protein lipid ratio, you'll have association of the protein molecules and under optimal circumstances form a two-dimensional crystal. In lipid monolayer crystallization, you'll hear more about this from Liz Kubelek, the idea is you have a lipid monolayer at an air-water interface, and as one example, imagine that you have, in this case, a soluble protein that has a His tag, and you dope the monolayer with a nickel lipid, which will bind the His tag molecules, and again, under optimal circumstances, you'll form a two-dimensional crystal. So I'd like to just briefly describe a low-resolution experiment exemplifying lipid monolayer crystallization, in situ crystallization at a little higher resolution, and then conclude with an atomic resolution analysis. And as a preamble, I point out this quote from Ephraim Racker, a scientist in the United States who planned such a tedious, dull, and perhaps fruitless project, that is, crystallization of membrane proteins, is well advised to delete it from the grant or hide it behind a screen of glittering experiments on site-directed mutagenesis. As you know, there's been a phenomenal success in the three-dimensional crystallization of membrane proteins. Several recent structures, aquaporins, channels, potassium channels, and transporters. But it's also possible to examine membrane protein structure using 2D crystallization. And here I compare X-ray crystallography of 3D crystals and electron microscopy of 2D crystals. And you can study this in detail. I just want to point out a couple of advantages and disadvantages. It may be the case that for growing two-dimensional crystals, you may not require much protein. So for situations where the protein doesn't express to a high yield, you can grow two-dimensional crystals, whereas maybe the case that in 3D crystallization, you need a protein solution at 10 milligrams per mil, and it may not be feasible if the protein does not express very well. The purification techniques may be identical. This would be for purifying protein detergent micelles, as for in vitro constitution. A major bottleneck in 2D crystallography is screening. And with light microscopy, you can screen a limbo plate in 30 seconds, 24 drops. To screen 24 grids would take about a day. So you can imagine that it's essential to automate the technology so that screening can be accelerated. Well, one advantage of 2D crystallography is that we can examine the membrane protein within the lipid bilayer in a native state, and it's possible to track functionally important states. As you know, Nigel Unwin has used this technique to look at the open and closed states of the acetylcholine receptor. Keep in mind that for 2D crystals, it's in a lipid bilayer, and the specimens are frozen in physiological buffers, which is much closer to the native state than 3D crystallization and high concentrations of ammonium sulfate or other precipitants. Well, let me give an example of lipid monolayer crystallization. For retroviruses, the GAG polyprotein molecules bind to the membrane via a myristoyl group, and they also interact via electrostatic interactions. And its crystal structures are available for the one protein component in GAG, the capsid protein. There's an amino terminal and carboxy terminal domain. And by analysis of helical tubes, Wes Sundquist proposed this kind of model for the quaternary organization of the molecules that would occur at the lipid bilayer, where the N-terminal domains form these hexamers, and then you have these C-terminal linkers. Eric Barkless was able to grow two-dimensional crystals of histag capsid. Crystals are huge. They're not very well ordered, so you can't perform electron diffraction. And he proposed that, in fact, for this particular retrovirus, murine leukemia virus, the quaternary organization was different than for HIV, as I showed you previously. And Barbie Ganser was able to repeat that analysis and, in fact, showed that murine leukemia virus and HIV have this similar organization. So it appears that the difference in the lattices between different retroviruses may have to do with these C-terminal linkers, where you can vary the angle and distance here to change the packing of the molecules in the lattice. Now let me move on to an intermediate resolution analysis of gap junctions that highlights in situ crystallization. And we're interested in gap junctions because they mediate the propagation of the action potential between cells in the heart and maintain the heartbeat and are intimately involved in lethal arrhythmias. Shown here is a beautiful study from Pepe Jalife's laboratory where now he's looking at guinea pig hearts, and he's able to perfuse the hearts with a fluorescent dye. So you can start to actually see the wave of current flow, and these are called current rotors. And this is the kind of arrhythmia that occurs in ventricular fibrillation that culminates in sudden death. This is 600 frames a second. A guinea pig heart beats at several hundred beats a second. Well, within the heart, the gap junctions are maintained in this connections between the cells called intercalated discs. And the topology of the protein family, the gene family of connexins is shown here, where in the heart it's a 43 kilodalton subunit with four transmembrane domains. Keep in mind that the gap junctions have to assemble, and they're transferred, thought to transfer to the membrane via vesicles, and then each half channel associates with a half channel in the opposing cell to form the intracellular conduit. And in the heart, the primary ion that's carried from cell to cell is potassium. But the channels can also accommodate molecules up to about 1,000 daltons. Well, I wanted to also show some of the imaging from Matthias Falk. And here, by using fluorescence microscopy, you can image gap junction plaque in a HeLa cell. And you can also perform live cell imaging, in this case using CFP-labeled CX43 isoform and YFP-CX26. And you can see how the two connexin isoforms intermingle in forming the plaque. Very dynamic. You can see the vesicles fusing with the membrane. And lastly, here, looking at the plane, you can see the fluidity of the plaque and the mixing of the two isoforms. As I said, the channels have to reach the membrane, and in this experiment, Matthias was able to label microtubules, tubulin with YFP, and connectin 43 with CFP. You can see how quickly these vesicles move at about 0.2 to 1 microns a second. So gap junctions in the heart turn over about every 5 hours. So in each day, you're sort of rebuilding these connections about 6 or 7 times. Well, we were able to isolate those patches and by extracting lipids form reasonable crystals, as you see here. They only diffract to, say, 15 angstroms resolution. And an important breakthrough was achieved by Nalin Kumar, who was able to express connexins in VHK cells. Vincent Bunger isolated the crystals, and in negative stain, the diffraction extends to sort of 25 angstroms resolution, and looking down on the plane of the bilayer, you can see that each half channel has 6 subunits. By freezing the crystals, Vincent was able to extend the resolution to about 7 angstroms resolution, and in projection, you can see the rich detail in the map where these circular contours are about the right size for alpha helices on end. This was quite a surprise because if you think about the docking of the two half channels, it's about 150 angstroms thick, and so we were quite surprised to see such a definition of the helices end on. And it implied something about how the two half channels may dock end to end. My analysis of tilted images and merging of the data, Vincent was able to derive a map at about 7.5 angstroms in plane, about 20 angstroms vertical, and the individual alpha helices are well resolved. And then in the extracellular region, you can see this continuous wall of protein. And this makes sense because you want connections just between the cytoplasm of the two cells so that in the extracellular space, you don't want free diffusion of the metabolites and ions into the extracellular space. So this was visual proof that each subunit has 4 transmembrane alpha helices. Well, we performed some modeling. Of course, the density has these rods of density. The density map shows these rods that we can dock helices into. But we really don't know the vertical or rotational orientation. We don't even know what the assignment is because we can't resolve the connecting loops. But we do have all the sequences, Interestingly, you see these charged residues here in a spot that M3 lines the pore, and cysteine labeling experiments support that idea. M1 is sensitive to voltage, and as you saw on the maps, there are two helices exposed to the pore, and so we presume that M1 and M3 line the channel. Rashmi Nunn and Tom Mackey then went on to do a more quantitative analysis looking at pairwise interactions between amino acid side chains. And the idea then is to take a low-resolution map as a constraint, the amino acid sequences, and then knowing how the residues interact, they constrain the packing. And for four helices and a hexamer, there are 24 possibilities. They ended up examining over 3 million conformations, and then they got married. But this still doesn't really provide a lot of information, because there are hundreds of solutions that are consistent with the data. And of course, we need to move to higher resolution. And Vincent has gone on to extend his analysis from 7.5 to 5.7 angstroms resolution. And I show a couple of sections here on the extracellular side of the bilayer. And right in the middle of the extracellular space, you can see the improvement in the definition. We think the M3 helix continues as an alpha helix into this extracellular space. And these wings of density that you see here may correspond to beta sheet. But the vertical resolution is still pretty low. It's about 18 angstroms resolution. Nevertheless, it's intriguing to try and assign helices. And if you notice in M4, there are two phenylalanines that are one helical turn apart. And in the 5.7 angstrom map, this one helix has this sort of intriguing shoulder of density. And what we did was take the E helix of bacteriorhodopsin, because in the low-resolution structure of bacteriorhodopsin, there were a couple of aromatics separated by one helical turn, and a similar shoulder of density was visualized. So this kind of approach allows us to suggest a possible assignment for one helix, M4, and then knowing M1 and M3, we have a suggested helical assignment. Ultimately, we need to improve the crystal so that we can record high tilt images. The tilt right now is limited to about 30 degrees or so. Well, I want to conclude with an atomic resolution story that exemplifies in vitro reconstitution. This is the analysis of aquaporins in Alok Mitra's laboratory. Aquaporins are very important in the body for maintaining fluid balance, of course, in the kidney. And Alok's group examined aquaporins isolated from red blood cell membranes. If you look at the topology, the polypeptides are thought to have arisen by gene duplication, where helix 1 is homologous to 4, 2 to 5, and 3 to 6. And then there are these conserved, what are called NPA boxes that are important for water transport. So keep in mind that it appears that there's duplication, and it's difficult to imagine where the symmetry would be. So it's unlikely that you would have a twofold symmetry axis perpendicular to the membrane. Instead, you'd expect it to be in the plane of the bilayer. As I said, Alok was able to grow beautiful 2D crystals by in vitro reconstitution, exemplified here. And Anqi Cheng derived a map at about 7 angstroms in plane resolution. And Anqi and Vincent are teaching the 2D crystallography as well as Alok. The 7 angstrom map reveals broads of density, similar to I just showed you in the gap junction channel, and allows you to infer that the transmembrane domains are alpha helices, but the resolution is not sufficient to define the location of amino acid side chains. Nevertheless, there's something intriguing about the map. If you look at sections within the hydrophobic core, if you superimpose a section here and a section here, then they don't match. But if you flip one, assuming there's a twofold axis of symmetry, you can see they superimpose quite well. This was in on sheets of paper. And the idea is that the polypeptides arose by gene duplication, and there's this pseudo twofold axis of symmetry within the hydrophobic core of the bilayer. And the explanation is that the protein really doesn't care which direction water is moving. It's not like a transporter. Water simply moves passively across the bilayer, into out and out to in. So you can see this was an expeditious way to solve that problem. More recently, Gary Wren solved a high-resolution structure, and I show here a couple of electron diffraction patterns. Now, these crystals are large enough that you can perform electron diffraction in the microscope, and at zero tilt, the data extends to a better than 3 angstrom resolution. Now, it's often the case that when you tilt 2D crystals in the microscope, there's a loss of information perpendicular to the tilt axis, and you can see how the diffraction pattern fades out in one direction here. Nevertheless, there are sufficient data so that a 3D map could be derived even in the vertical perpendicular to the plane of the bilayer. The resolution was about 5 angstroms. Well, you have to record the diffraction patterns to obtain the amplitudes, but images have to be recorded so you can compute transforms to derive the phases for the reflections. And this shows the distribution of Gary's data. It's just exquisite. Shown at the left is a refined density map. And now at high resolution, you can see density corresponding to bulky side chains. And you can build an atomic model, as you see here. Now, this is a slice through the center of the channel. So you see the water pores corresponding to two of the subunits. So the water channel is a tetramer, but each monomer contains a pore. So when you slice through the middle, you'll actually see two water pores. And this is unlike other channels, such as potassium channels, where they form a pore via a tetrameric arrangement of subunits. In the gap junction channels, for the you have a hexamer with a central pore. In this case, each monomer has a water pore. Well, analysis at this kind of resolution allows a proposal of models for water transport. And I conclude with this summary figure from the three-dimensional structure analysis from Murata et al. And as you know, Peter Agre received the Nobel Prize this year. And from electron crystallography of the aquaporin, they were able to delineate the location of the amino acid side chains. The pore has this bend in it as you proceed through the protein. And there are hydrophobic residues clustered here that would tend to exclude charged molecules. The pore is certainly wide enough to accommodate water molecules. But how are protons excluded from the channel? Analysis would suggest that in this region of the pore, as you extend down from the vestibule into this pathway, the water molecules can organize in a dipolar fashion. And if that continued all the way across the bilayer, then you could imagine transfer of protons, where you have the charge density of one hydrogen transferred to the next water molecule, and you form a so-called proton wire. Exclusion of protons was achieved via the NPA boxes. I described the conserved asparagine residues. And the positioning of the charges in the center of the pore disrupt the hydrogen bonding network with the between the water molecules. So you have orientation of the water dipoles as you proceed down, and then in the region of the NPA boxes, the water dipoles shift perhaps 90 degrees or so. But you disrupt the proton wire. And even though there's sufficient dimension to accommodate protons, by this mechanism, protons are excluded from the channel. It's a beautiful molecular story and based on electron crystallography. And with that, I thank you for your attention.